welcome to Worlds Apart. The final week before the change of power in Washington has been marked by a flurry of diplomatic activity that shows how differently countries around the world go about building their relationships. Some have struck highly detailed deals, others extended pledges of everlasting support, albeit with no strings attached. What style of international relations is likely to be more enduring? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Lisa Isaac, International Relations and Cooperation Specialist at Adige State University in Russia. Dr. Lisa, it's great to see you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Now, we live in a time when making confident forecasts about the future seem to be a thing of the past, with major geopolitical changes happening on an almost weekly basis, and yet amidst all this unpredictability, just as we record our interview, Russia and Iran are expected to sign a strategic partnership deal that will govern their relations for the next 20 years. Isn't it obsolete to try to commit to anything, let alone in interstate relations, on such a long time frame?
This comprehensive strategic treaty, which is set to be signed today between Russia and Iran, will replace the previous agreement that was signed in 2001. However, today's treaty is expected to be more comprehensive and vast. While there is no exact information available about the core areas of the treaty, it has been circulated through the media that the cooperation will not be limited to military and security issues. Rather, it will be encompasses a wide range of issues related to economy, transportation, energy sector, finance, among others. So having said that, it is important to notice that the establishing long-term agreements in international relations, such as the Strategic Partnership Treaty between Russia and Iran that spans over two decades, can enhance stability and predictability in their diplomatic and economic interactions.
Let's also admit that this is a somewhat outdated mode of maintaining international relations, because we don't see many countries doing something like that at this point of time. It's more about PR speeches, about loud announcements, but without any specific details, usually without any specific details noted on paper. Why do you think Russia and Iran are doing it at this moment, even though we know from our own sources that this agreement has been in discussion for many years, for at least 4 years? So it's not all of a sudden that they sign it. But why do you think they still prefer that form of cooperation?
This depends according to the international community that we live in. Looking at the current international U.S.-led order, we can see that Iran and Russia are facing comprehensive and very heavy challenges. Both countries are heavily sanctioned economy by the U.S.-led international order. So such a agreement, in my opinion, will help them to face the mutual challenges concerning economic sanctions imposed by the Western countries and U.S. In facing these common challenges, a long-term partnership agreement can facilitate more effectively coordination of their efforts.
Last year, Vladimir Putin signed a similar agreement with North Korea. It was also strategic and all-encompassing. It covered many areas, but it specifically focused on military cooperation, with the two countries pledging to support each other if they are attacked. Do you think such agreements in general could provide an effective deterrent against, let's say, theoretical Western strikes? Or on the contrary, are they more likely to sort of serve as an invitation to forces that want to undermine those nations?
Let's be a little bit realistic. For some countries, of course, they will perceive partnerships agreements such as one planned to be signed today between Russia and Iran, as well as the mutual defense treaty between Russia and North Korea last year, as a threat to their own security. I think that the countries or nations that they are looking at such partnership as a threat, they see the world world through a narrow and biased lens. First and most importantly, because they disgraded the rights of the citizens of these countries who have endured unjust economic blockades for years, just because these nations have made sovereign decisions. It's a plan for the world to follow according to the world-based order, with ultimately serving the interests of specific nations while neglecting the needs of the interests and the interests of others. Mm-hmm. These agreements arise as a reaction to their hostile actions toward Russia, threatening its security and borders through NATO's expansion, with Ukraine being the most vivid example of these policies.
I'm not sure I agree with you 100% here, because I think the Russian leadership, at least on many occasions, stressed that the reason why, the primary reason why they develop relations with other countries in such a format, in such a contractual long-term format, is because they believe that's the best way to ensure stability, and that's ultimately in their own interest. It's not just pledging, vocal support and doing nothing. It's actually, painstaking analysis of where the two countries can cooperate to deliver mutual benefit. And that's a totally different approach to partnership from, let's say, something that is based on ideological values that are not underwritten by concrete steps.
Well, of course, any partnership or any state that wants to make a long-term agreement with other countries should be taken from their own interest, national interest and national security. This is the primary goals of any sovereign state in international relations. This is if we are speaking about a normal situation, if we can describe it, without being threatened from external powers, you know what I mean. But in the case of Russia, with all this mobilization against it and against its policy and their attempts to isolate Russia, we can explain or we can interpret such partnerships with North Korea and with Iran as breaking this attempts to isolate Russia and putting in a position that it is being isolated around the world. And in this sense also, we can look at the Russian also attempts to break this kind of ruling, the order with establishment of a BRICS.
Absolutely. Let me ask you about that, because I know that you are a specialist on Russia's use of soft power. And I was wondering if by sticking to this long-term detailed agreements, Russia is also trying to essentially exemplify what kind of world order it wants to see. Something that is based on concrete agreements where countries actually stick to their words regardless of the political currents, when a treaty signed means a treaty signed and that it will last, for the time that that is specified. Do you think that's a form of power projection in any way?
First of all, we have to understand that soft power means that we are using all kinds of soft powers, for example, like diplomacy, like using cultural, even educational means. In that sense, if today's treaty will encompasses such as domains or areas, which is speaking about the cultural mutual exchanges, educational exchanges. Of course, Russia is going through using its own soft powers in its all means. And by the way, by doing that, Russia is not only applying soft power in its external or in the international policy, but Russia is using what they call it a grand strategy. Grand strategy means that you are using all the possible means and all tools that you have. Mm-hmm. So Russia is trying to magnify and extend all its international tools, if we can say, which by using not only the soft power, but also a grand strategy mm-hmm. in dealing of the current challenges of the and complexities of the international international system.
I want to contrast Russia's attitude to the world and the promises and the weight of those commitments to the one that was exemplified by the UK Prime Minister, who recently visited Kyiv, pledging in a tweet 100 of years of quote-unquote being with Ukraine. To me, it sounds like a promise of eternal love with no strings attached, no commitments made. I assume the Ukrainian people would want to have something more concrete or more specific. What do you think? Why do you think the West keeps sticking to this very ephemeral kind of policy?
The UK Prime Minister visit to Ukraine in such a critical moment before just a few days of Trump's reach to the White House, and with the Trump's promises to find a swift and fast peace or solution for the Ukrainian issue, I could read that, or it kind actually reminds me of the John Bolton visit to Ukraine in April 2022, if I'm not mistaken in the date, where he was, a lot of party had accused him that he also spoiled the peace agreement, that it was about to be reached between Russia and Ukraine. So in that sense, not only UK, before a few days, foreign ministry also reached to Ukraine to solidify and to assure that the Germany also supported the Ukraine.
But Dr. Lisa, this is my exact point. I mean, they sure make their visits. And, you know, today they come and tomorrow they go. But in terms of what Ukraine actually does, or what any other country that falls for these promises actually receives, it's still unclear, because I assume the Ukrainian people would want to know, you know, how much money, how much assistance they would receive on reconstruction, you know, how their army will be funded. You know, these are the details that the countries used to put in interstate agreements. What we have at the moment is the West sending the countries to wars with their neighbors, promising them support for 100 of years and not actually committing to anything on paper. And what I cannot understand is, why do you think some of those nations and their leaderships seem to be so spellbound by this kind of appeals or by this kind of promises?
I don't know anybody who could or who would reject a peace agreement, to reach a peace agreement which will bring stability and will bring a reconciliation and reconstruction, as you said, to the Ukraine and to the to Russia as well, and to combine the Russian and the Ukrainian again. So in my opinion, that Zelensky, by taking these steps, by escalation even before just a few days of the Trump comes to the power, and with his own promises that he will bring peace to the conflict. I mean, he is going against his own people interests and his own people sustainability and security. Or if he is going through his own personal interest, in that sense, nobody can find an explanation to this steps, escalation steps, either that he is going just for his own interest and his own personal interest and maybe business. We don't know.
Okay, well, Dr. Lisa, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
Thank you. there's no end in sight over how you're going to continue to destroy the Earth.
It's the case of the madness of the people.
I tried to go to the gym, but I'm certainly not ready to fight Russia.
This is all so absurd.
This is third world lunacy. Brainwashing.
As Ursula von der Leyen likes to say, we have the tools.
Why don't we just start with stability and business deals?
What planet are you living on, man?
We have very good propaganda in our press here in Europe.
I think we don't know the aftermath.
Anytime that you're not allowed to ask questions, you should ask all of the questions.
The more questions asked, the better the answers will be.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Lisa Isaak, International Relations and Cooperation Specialist at Adige State University in Russia. Dr. Lisa, we started our conversation by discussing the treaty between Russia and Iran, but there is another deal in the making or supposedly already signed, the one on the ceasefire in Gaza, mediated by Qatar, Egypt, and the United States. The Biden administration pushed a lot for this deal. It was sort of discussed behind closed doors, but on a very short time scheme. What's your intuition? Is it likely to succeed?
Well, indeed, Qatar announced yesterday the success of the collective efforts of Egypt, U.S. and Qatar to reach temporary ceasefire agreements in Gaza between Israel and Hamas. Well, it is a three-stage ceasefire with many details supposed to be implemented on the 19th January. It's a start, of course, with the 6 weeks of temporary cessation of the military operations by both parties. In my opinion, the likelihood of the agreement success and sustainability is promising, especially considering that Donald Trump will soon take office and is not in favor of starting his term with a conflict. He has warned also and promised a hell to Middle East in case of not reaching this kind of ceasefire. And here we saw that just before a few days of coming to the White House, the 15 months of the war has come to be silent. So in my opinion, the timing of this agreement indicates that both parties have reached a stage in which we call it in conflict and war studies, mm-hmm. a fatigue mm-hmm. stage. Hamas can't offer to be any more stubborn. Tel Aviv is unlikely to impose measures more severe than those already experienced in the Gaza. Add to these factors to the existence of a stronger power, well, to put an end to the conflict and get a ceasefire ultimately.
You said that you believe that this conflict has reached its peak, but for now, the discussion is primarily on the ceasefire, on the release of the Israeli hostages and the Palestinian detainees, but there is no discussion about historical and political grievances of the Palestinians. Where do you think it leaves the main question of this conflict?
I think that Trump is going to initiate or launch a peace process accord or a peace process initiative that would be announced by the U.S. for the Middle East, basically to find as a solid and final solution for Israel and Palestinian court. Of course, I don't think that Hamas will be welcomed participants in this upcoming political landscape. The Palestinian Authority is also weakened by its already internal divisions. So in my opinion, we might see a new phases in the future in negotiations. It will proceed without the presence of the figures who has instigated the conflict, especially suggesting that Netanyahu himself and his extremists or his extremist government may be also sidelined in that. However, a peace process will be launched under a Trump administration, like Abraham Accord formula. I think it will be the basis of this process, which is basically a peace for peace formula, peace by force, which might include all relevant parties in Middle East. So basically, the conference may also involve representative from the Palestinian Authority, maybe Lebanon also will be come along, and Syria as well.
Mm-hmm. One thing I noticed over the last couple of weeks since the election of Trump is that there is barely any mention of all the UN resolutions on the Palestinian question. Do you think any of those resolutions, which are still considered to be part of the international law canon, do you think they still bear any significance at this point?
Well, in my own opinion, that UN resolutions are similar to UN disengagement and observer forces. For example, in the Syrian Golan Heights, there were international observation forces tasked with monitoring the situation. However, after the fall of Assad, we saw that how HTS, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, forces left the area. And because Israel has ceased the implementation of the disengagement agreement and invaded, subsequently occupied the entire city of Quneitra, what did the UN peacekeeping force do? They couldn't do anything regarding that. Therefore, I believe that the discussions about the UN nations and its affiliation organization should include considerations about the need of reconsidering the reconstructioning the international system itself that has dominated since the Second World War. Reforming the United Nations is an urgent necessary for building a new multipolar order, which can address such issues like the Palestinian cause that you have mentioned.
Now, I gather that you are not very optimistic on the prospects of a Palestinian state, as you are not, you don't seem to be that optimistic on the return of the Golan Heights to Syria. But that would suggest that the policy that Israel and the United States pursued for so many decades, the policy of force, the policy of bloodshed, the policy of diktat, uncompromising diktat, that it has succeeded.
We can't say that it has been succeeded. Maybe temporary in the current, according to the current event and the trajectory of the events that we could see since the 7th of October 2023. I mean, the bulk of the people who were supporting what they called the resistant front, they were all optimistic that this 7th October will bring some just to the Palestinian cause. But what will happen then, the repercussion of that insult, that it broke the opposite, the exactly opposite desired outcome. Look at the resistance front now. I mean, there is no around. Look at Hamas in Gaza, what happened, toppling the Hamas leaders, erosion of the strengthening of Hamas in Gaza. In Lebanon, the same scenario. We could see that Israel managed to topple the first and second toppest leaders, and most importantly, Hassan Nasrallah himself. In Syria, the whole regime has been toppled. I mean, and looking at Iran, Iran is left alone again in this arena.
Well, this is actually one of the biggest questions in global politics in the year of 2025. What will happen between Israel and Iran? Whether Israel, emboldened by its advances in Syria, will go ahead with direct strikes against Iranian nuclear facilities, or whether Iran will continue its policy of very sort of public belligerence towards the West, towards Israel, and serve, therefore, either the Trump administration or the Israeli government an overt pretext for attacking them. How do you think these two nations will sort of navigate their animosity in these new circumstances when the price of escalating is so high?
First of all, to answer this question, we must recognize that Israel, we know today, is not the same as the one existed prior to October 7. As following this date, Israel, backed by the U.S., has been operating in the Middle East without regard for international law, for human rights, even global public opinion. They don't see any of these. They know one thing, that October offensive has posed a significant threat to Israel's existence. So given the statements from Israel officials, particularly from Netanyahu himself, it seems for me that it is reasonable to believe that Israel indeed determined to target Iran. However, it looks like it will target, for, in my own opinion, the Houthis backed by Iran in Yemen first to protect itself from any potential strikes from other territory. So the question here is not whether Israel has the courage to strike Iran or not. The question is how and when we'll do that. Let's not forget that Israel has gone a long way destroying Hamas, Hezbollah, and Assad in Syria to reach Iran in the end, right? So, but how and when? This nobody can predict. But we can see, if we want to answer that question, we can look from all the data and all the events that it's happening around us. It seems that Israel and the United States are in favor of a regime change scenario that it happened with Assad. Similar might be applied in Iran as well, where Iranian government may therefore become a target for internal destabilization with efforts made to mobilize the country's opposition forces to drive change from within. So by weakening Iran from within and exerting economic pressure through additional sanctions, the West might aim to exert concessions from Iran in regards of its new clear program. Essentially, the goal is to clip Iran's claws and deprive it from its strategic influence, making it more more vulnerable to external manipulation and substituted to internationally. Of course, same strategy, by the way, have applied in Syria and have succeeded.
Well, and the same strategy they tried to apply to Russia, but it has not succeeded yet. And hopefully with countries like Russia, China, and the global majority that actually wants to live by international law, that is in favor of long-term cooperation, that is in favor of agreements that are signed to be upheld. I hope the sort of scenario you're describing will not realize itself, but we will have to wait and see. Dr. Lisa, we have to leave it there. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.